Opera Out of the Box, unpacking opera piece by piece. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and we're continuing our series of important conversations leading up to Toledo Opera's production of South Pacific. It's happening soon. And today we're welcoming some very special guests here in our studio. So we have Mary Kamadoy, who is a World War II Japanese internment camp survivor and a 37-year retired employee of Ford Motors and also a founding member of American Citizens for Justice. And we have Keiko Han, who is a World War II Japanese war bride and the subject of a war bride's documentary. We're going to talk about that with the president of the Lima Sister Cities Association, Matthew Neely. We also have Toledo Opera's Leo Whitaker here with us. So let's start with you, Mary. Tell us a little bit about your experience. I think a lot of people are not, you know, necessarily knowledgeable about the experience. I wonder if you can give us sort of the speech of what you do.
Well, you know, when the war started, everybody in Japan, in California, was Issei's. Issei is my parents. That's the first generation. And Nisei's are myself. I'm second generation. And so the Issei's were all just in big turmoil, wondering, what are we going to do? The first thing that they thought about was that they may all be rounded up and sent back to Japan. But their biggest worry was also worrying about the children. We were all born in America, and we've never been to Japan. And the parents thought, what are we going to do if they take all the children away from us? And, you know, as I'm from a family of 10 children, my older brothers and sisters used to tell my mom and dad, don't worry about those things. Right now, we got to worry about what they're going to do with us, all of us, not just the children. And so we waited and waited, and they would send out notices to us. If you want to know what you have to do, you have to go to large buildings and telephone poles because we'll post the posters. And so you have to go to these places to learn what is in store for us. What are we going to do next with, you know, our people? And so we would go to telephone poles and businesses and read. And finally they decided that they were going to set us on a curfew. Well, you know, being everybody in California, they're running farms. They're not close to telephone poles and stuff. So we would have to send the older children to find telephone poles, find out what we were supposed to do. So they had finally posted a notice that we were going to all be sent to camp. And so right away, my parents worried that, they're going to send all the children to camp. Probably they'll just do away with us. And my older sisters and brothers just could not understand, couldn't make my parents understand, don't worry about these things. There's nothing we can do about it. But we did worry. And so finally, when we were told that we would be going to camp, all the Issei's, they thought, they're just telling us to lock the doors and just take whatever you can. You can't take any more than what you can carry. So what they were doing was, they never thought that we would leave the homes and never make it back. So they were digging holes in the backyard. And I would go out and see my mother doing that, and she'd be cutting the lining of coats and everything. And I used to say to my older sisters and brothers, you better go out there and see. I think Mom is going crazy. So I finally said to her, what are you doing, Mom? You need to get to bed. She said, well, you know, you can't carry valuable paperwork and just a bundle of whatever you're going to be bundling, you know, to carry. Because people at that time weren't traveling much, so you didn't see very many people with suitcases. So what we had to do was take sheets and bedspreads and blankets and tie everything up in that. And so I said, but Mom, what are you doing? I asked her again. I thought maybe she was cracking up, but she said to me, she said, see, I'm ripping all this, and the papers that Father and I brought here from Japan that allows us to stay here and everything, we're putting all this in this lining of my coat, and then I'm going to sew it all up. I said, what do you mean you're going to put everything in the lining? Well, you know, I was only 11 years old. I don't have the brains to know all this. So I asked her, and she said, Mary, if we put it in this coat here lining, I'm going to stitch the bottom of this. So when I do this, it won't fall out. I said, oh, okay, that makes sense. So then she started tearing my father's jacket. And I said, is that what you're going to do, put all the important paper in his jacket too? She said, we have to. We don't have any suitcases because...
Yeah.
And so anyway, I understood then. And the next day, I saw her digging on the flower bed. And I said to my sisters, I said, what is she digging on the flower bed? She can't take the bulbs that was during the dahlias that what she was growing. And my sister says, oh, who knows what she's doing, you know. Our parents are all sort of confused and you know, so they're just not making any sense. And I said, well, I'm going to find out why she's digging a hole. And so I went over to her and asked her, and she said, because, she said, you know, our valuables that we can't take, we're going to bury them in the ground. So when we come back, at least we'll have some of our valuables and they'll be buried.
Mm.
And so I thought, well, lots of luck, Mom, because I don't think you're going to be coming back.
Yeah.
I mean, the instructions we got were just not clear. And so that's the way the Isseis did. They would bury things in there behind their homes, and thinking that they're going to go home. But after the war ended, actually, none of the Isseis had a home or any farms or anything that they had been working on before the war. And when they went back to California, they had nowhere to live. So they lived wherever they can find a roof over their head. And it was the same thing with Japanese people being put into camps.
Yeah.
It wasn't just in my city. It was just all over in California. So, you know, even when we went into camp, when we went there, our homes were going to be the horse stables. And so when we got there, we got out of the trucks and we got there and all the Isseis were standing there. What are we doing at a horse stables?
Yeah.
So finally the MPs got up and told us what units we were assigned, and what we had to do was take all the bales of hay that were put there, take it apart and lay it on the grounds of the stables, because the horse stables were wet and damp and dirty. And so that's what the Isseis did for days. But you could never get the smell of those horse stables out.
Yeah.
And eventually, people were getting health problems. And the government finally realized, these people are all getting ill. The horse stables might be doing this. So they hurried up and they built these camps throughout the West Coast. And these camps were all built in the inner cities, away from the water and everything. But I got sent to Arkansas, we never figured it out. There was one camp that opened in Arkansas, and my family and all the people that were living in my area were sent to Arkansas. But we could never get any answers, so my parents used to say, don't ask any questions because we might get in trouble and they're liable to put you on the next boat sending you to Japan, whether you were mm-hmm. born there or not. So we were very careful what we said in the camps. And my mom and dad always told us kids, don't talk to strangers, because we never knew the people that were going to be living near us. I broke the rules that my mom always threw at us kids, don't talk to strangers. Well, I was always wandering around talking to strangers. And so
you're doing that right now.
Yes, I do. And my mother would always get a hold of me, and she said, I'm going to lock you up in your room, you know, you don't listen to me. And I said, but Mom, what am I supposed to do in the room? It's just a bed and a stove in there. What do you want me to do in there? She said, well, just sit on your bed. And she said, you won't talk to strangers.
Mm.
Oh, okay. So that lasted for the day. Then I would sneak out and I'd be all over the place. And she would be sending my older sisters and brothers to look for Mary, you know, because I don't know where she's at. And they all said, we don't know where she goes.
Yeah.
And so I was just that type of kid at that age. Always did things that we weren't supposed to do.
Yeah. I want to talk with Keiko, and first, you were a Japanese war bride. Maybe you can tell people what that is, just so they know, and your personal experience, because it was all documented in this documentary, which we're going to talk about. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your experience as a Japanese war bride.
First of all, I didn't know there was a word like war bride. I might have war bride, but I guess it was because I married a man from America who fought Japan and they were once our enemy. So I was surprised but accepted it, but I didn't know what it meant. But I found out later war brides at that time was looked upon as what is the best word? Pariah? Or someone to avoid? Mm-hmm. And look down on them. Mm-hmm. Because I was married to an American who once was an enemy. So, not only I, but my family suffered. Just because I was walking a street with an American. But he was a friend from my office, and he wanted to see Japan while he was assigned in Tokyo and Yokohama. I refused to go with him at first, but I felt sorry for him and I thought it over because he had to be confined in that office and camp, and only thing he saw was devastation of burned cities. That camp was located where I was born. And if you go a little outside by the seaside, there's a beautiful gardens and some places, parks, that the bomb didn't explode. Had a planetarium, gardens, shrines, and it's a pity that he goes home just with a memory of devastation of war. So I consented to take him to the places that still stand as beautiful as it was. And that's how I start to know my husband, future husband. Well, anyhow, many people, including Japanese and American, didn't accept me at first when I came to Ohio. There was still the memory of the war.
When did you come to the United States?
1951 in September, maybe 6, I landed at Seattle, Washington.
How did you feel at the time coming to the U.S. and leaving behind the Japanese culture?
Harder than I expected. When I left Japan, I went to my family home and said goodbye to my parents. My mother told me, I'm not going to see you at the harbor when you leave from Yokohama, because ship goes away so slowly, and I have to bear the pain all that time. If I say goodbye now, pain is less. So, goodbye. But my sister said, I'll go. Well, she was only maybe middle school. Anyhow, she came to the harbor, and we had many people at the harbor who were going to America. And I grabbed the tape, one end of the tape, and she grabbed the other side, the other end of tape, and ship started to move. And when that tape just slipped away from me, I cried. I decided I wasn't going to cry, but it was very hard, because 1951, well, there's no internet, and air freight was so expensive, I know that we couldn't afford it. So anyhow, when I left Japan, I was really devastated. But to make it short, when I came to Seattle, Washington, there was ships spewing water and creating beautiful rainbows. And band was striking up to welcome back their GIs, their sons, their husbands, their boyfriends. And deck pier was filled with those people, also happy and waving flags. And I thought, people are same. Parting is a sorrow. And greeting them back alive, because, you know, there was Korean War on.
Yeah.
So I was happy for them. And I memorized it. People are same. Wish that we kept peace instead of war.
Yeah. And a lot of your experience was reflected in this documentary about war brides. I mean, that's, you know, where they took off from. Matthew Neely is here. Matthew is the president of the Lima Sister Cities Association and responsible for the documentary. How did that idea come about?
The original idea was developed by TBS, which is Tokyo Broadcast Systems in Japan. And they are the ones that wanted to move forward and present a documentary about war brides. And it was actually Keiko's family who happened to be the director of this. Mm. And he was thinking back and like, oh, my aunt was a war bride. So that first initially got the ball rolling. He flew to America several years ago, interviewed her, spent a bunch of time, learned her story in depth, got history, photos. They had teachers that study this in Japan put their input in, and built a very nice documentary about war brides that premiered in Japan. We helped facilitate showing the documentary in Lima, and then from there, it actually got picked up by the Bowling Green PBS station, and they've aired it at least once, and I think they're starting to work on maybe another airing date.
Yeah.
But that's how it originally developed. Tokyo Broadcast Systems wanted to build this to share with the world so history wasn't lost.
Was it in Japanese or English at first?
The documentary was all recorded in Japanese, and it's all in subtitles.
Oh, okay.
So before they brought it to us, they had a department subtitle the entire documentary. So you get to practice reading while you're watching it, but it's very informative. And just as her story, it's heartfelt and it just touches you.
Yeah.
May I? This documentary, my biography, was because I kept my diary of what happened when I was so disturbed or happy. I didn't have many people to talk to except to write down. So I took my notebook, wrote what I really felt into the pen, and wrote it all down. Mm-hmm. And many years later, I decided my children went to Japan with me a few times, but my grandchild, who is now a junior professor at the Cincinnati University, I'm proud of her, of course. But anyhow, she was small. She doesn't really know me because she didn't live when I was having all these problems or happiness. So I dedicated my biography to my granddaughter, Heather. And then I thought, well, my children should have it, and my family back in Japan should have it, so they know how I lived in America, how I survived, and sometimes I was very happy, and sometimes it's very sad. So I made a copies of my biography. I typed them all out and sent copies to my granddaughter and my family and my sister. My sister's son, Ryutaro, I met him a couple times, but he was this small. But now he is a movie director for the TBS drama, and now he has experience making a biography. Well, anyhow, I sent them to Japanese family, and he happened to read it. And
your biography?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he decided to show it to the board of TBS.
Mm-hmm.
And because they are looking for some biography, they are going to have a biography festival.
Mm.
And so he presented my biography, and they took it up and never expected, you know, like that. I was 91 at that time.
How did you feel about the whole situation, about them making a biography, turning it into pictures?
You know, I kind of dreamed maybe it would be, someone will read it, but I had mixed emotion. I was delighted, but felt incredulous. Is that what the word is? Anyhow, it's incredible to me. Must be someone up there likes me.
Was there anything in your biography or in your diaries, let's say, that was too personal to share? Or did you decide when you were sharing your story with others some things not to include, or did you share everything?
And would you tell us if that were
true? Well, and is there anything about your time that you still feel shame or embarrassment, or do you still have, you know, feelings from that time about being an outsider, or, you know, having the stigma from your culture in Japan?
Not too much, because I went to a Christian mission school, French mission school, and my teachers were mixed with American, French, Irish, and there was a Mary White missionary from America. So I didn't have too much stigma about foreigners like many other people, because I was in school with them.
Mm-hmm. When you came to the United States, that period when you were first here in Seattle, do you remember those first few months and that culture shock, or that, what were some of the first, besides the parades, and you had that realization that we're all the same, and after that, and you were settling into your new life, what were some of the biggest, maybe, surprises or heart, like, what was really difficult in the beginning for you to get used to? Everything, I'm assuming.
Yeah. There's so many things, but the kindness of people.
Okay.
Because my husband's father worked for the Trinity United Methodist Church for 27 years or something. He was a custodian. And at that time, Pastor Dr. Jones told congregations that to welcome me. Because he was missionary in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
His whole family was in Japan for a while. So he tried to break the stereotype of, hate Japanese, one's an enemy, and so on and so on. So when I came to the church for the first time, congregation welcomed me. And my in-laws were very kind to me. They were not rich, but they let me stay a month, no, a year with them until I get used to how to run a household.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, what I had to get used to was diet, what you eat.
Mm-hmm. Well, peanut butter and jelly.
More like fried chickens and gravy and mashed potatoes and
not a lot of seafood, probably.
She didn't even have a shrimp, or have never had shrimp. Of course, Ohio was inland, and at that time, I don't think frozen food was as good. I mean, good supply.
Yeah,
you know, Japanese food.
Yeah. No. One day she said she realized I didn't know how to cook American food, so she said, "Well, maybe you can make a salad for us." And give me iceberg lettuce. And I just stood there. What am I going to do with this? And she had to show me how. That's how.
Yeah.
One of the culture shocks, I just had to get used to.
I'm still like that. I don't know how to cook.
Yeah. Yeah, you told us about your eggs.
There's a difference between not wanting to cook and being unable to cook.
I don't want to cook.
And even when I went to a grocery store, I was looking for an onion or radish. Can't find them. There used to be A&P store.
Oh, yeah.
And so employee came and said, "What are you looking for? Can I help you?" So I said, "I want to have a radish." "What radish?" I said, "Yes." So he takes me to the this section, and he got red bunch of radishes, bunch of red radishes. And I said, no, this is not the type of radish. It's white, this big, this long. Daikon?
Yeah, daikon.
Daikon, okay.
It's white Japanese radish.
Right. And that's why I said,
you can't get that in Lima.
Radish. But he thought just one little red radish. And I was looking for green onions. And what he showed me was green onion, real pencil thin, only this long. What, remember, naganegi?
Leeks.
Looks almost
like a leek.
It's tenderer. Just imagine that the green onion you see on the market, but sides
of a leek.
Characteristically same.
Okay.
But anyhow, starting with the basic things like food, it was kind of shock for me. My gosh, they don't have what I want.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get used to new foods.
Well, to keep this from turning into a cooking podcast.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
We're talking with Keiko Han, who is a Japanese war bride, the subject of a documentary about her experience. Also, Mary Kamadoy has joined us. She is an internment camp survivor, a Japanese internment camp. I mean, not a lot of people, I think, are aware of this dark period in American history. What for you? I mean, you're known as an activist. You've been an activist. You worked for Ford Motor Company. I wonder if you can talk about why it's important that people need to know this.
Well, because they're, you know, especially for this young generation that's coming up, I think children should all know about it. This is why I make my rounds of high schools and middle schools and academies of all. In fact, I'm going tomorrow to speak at an academy. And you know, the children are shocked to hear about it. And they want to know, how come you're sitting there and you're not crying?
Yeah.
I said, because with me, I said, you know, I'm not a person that's going to break down and cry over everything. When I get upset and there's something that has to be done, I'm going to do it. And I don't care who I'm talking to. I will speak up and tell you what was wrong. And so I said, this is why I said I could sit here and talk to you people all day long, and you have questions, and I'm glad to answer your questions. Because as you grow up to be grown-ups, you need to know these things. I said, you know, I actually had to go to Virginia to learn about the Civil War. When I started working, I had no idea where the Civil War was at or what happened or anything. Mm-hmm. And so I went on a trip with a girlfriend of mine, and we went to the area where the Civil War was, and it was very interesting. I learned a lot, and this is why I said I speak to children's at children's schools. I go to universities and speak to them, and I said, and it surprises me how students that are in the universities don't know the first thing about what happened during World War II.
That's right.
And so, you know, I said, it's just not right that this generation isn't learning all this, because this is an important part of their lives. It's going to be when you start having children. What are you going to tell them?
Yeah.
So, you know, all the students are very, especially at University of Michigan and Michigan State and all, they're very grateful that I come out and I will tell them the story, because I'm not going to say, oh, I can't talk about it, because this is what happens. I have had two professors from Wayne State. I thought, well, they were in the camp, so, you know, why am I doing all this talking and going around to all the schools? So I asked them if they would go to a school with me. And I couldn't believe the two men that were teaching at Wayne State broke down and they could not speak about it. Mm. And I asked them later, I said, why did you two break down on me? Because, Mary, if you have lived the life that we have, it's hard to even think about it, to think that we lived the way we did. It was before, I was below poverty level, really. And we're surprised that we're still alive, really, and healthy as we are. And so I said, but you have to let people know this, because number one, I said, you know, especially in the Michigan area, because this is auto country, the feeling of the Japanese people is terrible. Mm-hmm. They've been discriminating against this, discriminating, and because it's auto country, and every time the car slumps came along, when I worked at Ford, they used to come up to my office and tell me that my people caused their parents to get laid off. I said, what are you talking about, my people?
Yeah.
And after a while, I just got so tired of it. So whenever an hourly man came up and talked about my people, I would say, wait, stop right there. What people are you talking about? Your people. And I said, so who are these people? So they'd stutter around trying to tell me what I was and what I would do. It would irritate me so badly that I said, to begin with, I'm not from Japan. I'm not from China. I'm from Korea. And at that time, you weren't hearing a lot about Korea. And I thought, this will throw them off. They're going to go home and look it up in a dictionary where Korea is, because they're not going to know. And they said, Korea. How do you pronounce the name? And I told them, where are they? They thought they were here in the United States somewhere. And I said, no, no, no. This is like overseas. And I wasn't from Korea. I just told them I was.
You were an American citizen, huh?
Yeah, you know, and I thought, you guys are so dumb. What do you learn in school? And so, you know, I actually fought my way through Ford's because of the discrimination. And it got to the point where I'm one of these two, that can be nasty. If they would tell me, your people, I'd say, what are people you talking about? If they had said Japanese, I'd say, no, I'm from China. And so, you know, I would just throw them off. And they'd feel like fools. And I became friends that way. Because now they thought, oh, well, she's okay. And also, here they're coming upstairs and buying me cups of coffee. Because we had to buy our coffee out of vending machines. So I was having cups of coffee on my desk lined up. And my boss would say, how come you got so many coffee? And I said, well, I'm saving them. And he said, no, really, why do you have so many cups of coffee? I said, did you see that, the old man that was in my office a few minutes ago? And he said, yeah, you were waving your hand, he was waving his hand, and you were shouting at him. I said, next time he comes here, I said, oh, I'm not going to be shouting or anything, he's going to feel it. And so I said, I didn't want coffee, but when he brought coffee up, he had coffee in his hand. He said, well, I should have brought you a cup of coffee up. I said, you know what? I don't do favors in my office for anybody. Why would you buy me a hot cup of coffee? Well, because I want to ask you about your people. And I said, what people are you asking about? And I would tell them, I'm an American. I was born in California. Do you know where California is? Yeah, somewhere way on the other side. I said, yeah, dumb. I didn't feed you anything. So I would tell them where California is, and I said, so, you know, I said, so I was born there, and I'm probably, by looking at you, I'm more American than you are. I was born and raised in this country, and you don't look as old as I am. Oh, well, I'm 23 years old. I said, I got you beat by miles. I'm older than you, and I've been on this earth longer than you, so don't talk to me about different countries. But, you know, it's something that we just went through every day. And most of the Niseis, they're like the Iseis, you know, don't ask questions, just go along with the flow, you know, and whatever they say, just bow your head and walk away. I said, no, 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 no. You need to tell these people the truth so they'll learn something. They're going to be dumb for the rest of their life and think that that's what we are. We were all born overseas. And, you know, this was something that just went on all the time. So finally, when I started speaking up and telling the Aori people, number one, get out of my office. Mm-hmm. Number two, you're leaving all the grease from the plant in my office. I'm going to give you a paper towel, clean it up. My boss would watch me from another office. He'd wonder, what is this man doing? What's Mary waving her hand around? But he didn't have the nerve to come over to my office to ask what was going on. He'd wait until they left, and he'd come over and say, what's going on, Mary? You're standing there waving your hand, your mouth is going 50 miles an hour, and the man's got a paper towel. I said, yeah, this can happen to you, too, if you step out of line with me. And so he said, well, I'm not going to step out of line with you, but I told him what happened. He said, oh, one of those dummies, huh? I said, yeah, and I think he's one of your people. And he said, you mean he's German? And I said, yeah. He wants to know where I'm from, what I am. So I said, you know, and my boss didn't know where I was born or anything. So I said, I told him I was born in Korea. And the Koreans aren't building cars, bringing here or taking anybody's jobs. So what are you talking about? Well, the Aori people believe me. Yeah. And when I got to know the Aori people real well, I did change my tune and I told them the truth. I said, I use that because you people didn't know who I was or where I was born, and you were calling me everything under the sun. So, you know, I said, I was just straightening you out, mental condition. Oh, well, my goodness, you know, I really like you. I said, you don't need to like me because I really don't like you. So they'd go and buy me coffee. They'd ask if they could take me to lunch and all that. And I said, no, I don't take freebies from anybody. And I said, I don't even know you people. And they said, well, we know you because you've been here a long time. We work out in the plant. And I said, good, you can go back to the plant. You get all these insults. And so, you know, I just told myself, I'm not going to put up with this. And if I have to go to Henry Ford with my complaint, I would have done that.
Yeah.
But I had all the managers in my plant real nice to me because they found out what Mary is all about, and she don't take no guff from anybody. And they tell me that. And that's why they would be friends of mine. But right. I was very honest about everything, and I handled my problems myself. I didn't go, you know, tattling on them. And so they started to respect me for it. And so I really, before I retired, I had everybody under my thumb, really. Yeah. And my friends used to say, why are you retiring? You got everybody under your thumb. There's no manager here that would say, Mary, no. And I said, well, you have to know how to handle them. But really, I had told all my friends that I said, the only reason is because I stand up for my rights. And everybody has that right as an American citizen to stand up for the rights, and yeah. I do a good job of it. So I said, that's why they tell me they like me, because they respected me for standing up for myself. You know, after going through camp and coming out and living in such poverty, you didn't know where you're gonna get your next meal and all. And especially with the Issei's, they worried about the children. They didn't worry about whether they had a meal or not. And so, you know, I think through all of that hardship we went through after the war and all, and nobody would rent to us, nobody would hire us, you know, it just makes you a stronger person. And that's why I'm as strong as I am. And I tell my friends that are, you know, as old as I am, how did you do that, Mary? And I said, you know, I said, you have the right to speak up if you're right, and you don't have to take this. And I did this all my life.
Yeah.
And I said, maybe sometimes they prove me wrong, but I accepted it. So I said, but you know, I said, if you don't speak up, you're gonna still be called the dumb foreigner. That was a line that we used all the time, because we never responded back to the nasty remarks. And so that's when I learned my lesson. These people are telling me that they're called dumb foreigners and all this was because they didn't defend themselves. And I would preach to my friends, don't walk away when they insult you. That's why they call you the dumb foreigner. And if that's what you want to be called, that's your business. But since you live here in America, you live the American life, and you don't allow these people to do this to you. That's just being nasty.
Mm.
And because you you walk away, they're doing it more so. And it's, you know, and getting back to the War Bride, I was very busy and active with the War Brides in Detroit. And they, because it's a Detroit, it's a different type of world for us and for anybody working. And if they feel like, oh, well, you're Jewish and they don't like Jewish, they'll rip you apart. Mm-hmm. So they started that with the Japanese people. And I stood up for my rights at work any time I had to. And when the bosses would start on me, I would tell them, you know, you may be having a better position than I have. You might be a manager here and there, but you're still just a human being working every day, 8 to 5. So, I said, I don't know what makes you think you're any better than I am.
Yeah.
I eat and I drink and I do all the things that everybody else does. I get up in the morning, get dressed, and I'm here at 8 o'clock, and I quit at 5 o'clock. So there's no difference in who I am. I may look different, but you people have to understand. You go out there and stand on the road, and if there's a parade of people, no two people are going to look alike. They're going to look different. So I don't know why you people pick on the Japanese community. And so, you know, especially the ladies that were, you know, war brides, they had a terrible time. So I joined forces with another lady that had an American husband. And Mrs. Parks said to me, it's terrible, Mary, can you help me? And I said, well, if you can get the crowd together, we'll have a meeting at your house if you don't mind, and if you don't want it at your house, I can get a hall, you know. But I said, we need to talk to the ladies. They should not put up with that treatment. Just because, you know, they were new here, and the language wasn't as perfect as as the people that are born here. And I said, so, you know, we're going to teach them Sachiko. And Sachiko herself was a war bride, but she had taught in Japan, so her English was quite good. And she knew the style of living here in America, so she would talk to the war brides and tell them that you have the right to be here, so speak up. And if you have any problems, you can call Mary Kamado.
Well, I've got some questions for Keiko a little bit. So some things that Mary was mentioning in, you know, in her interactions with her coworkers and the Detroit culture, especially in the auto industry and that competition with Japanese auto manufacturers and the American. I'm wondering where you lived in Lima. At what point do you think that, like, did you feel any of this kind of, you know, business competition? Or, you know, what was the culture in Lima for you? It's a smaller town, obviously. Were there any other Japanese people there? And what were their...
There's a plant there in Lima.
There was few.
Yeah, okay. There's a plant.
But some of them, I think her husband was still in army and left. I came to Lima as a second person, but the person who stayed in Lima permanently. After me, there was some, let's see, Okinawans came over and some Japanese. But I was looked upon as the first Japanese settler. Mm-hmm. And
wow.
Before I go on too much, that may I say something?
Please, yeah.
There's an incident I really swore to do something about. That was when I took my American citizenship, because at that time that you have to wait so long to take an even test for the American citizenship, and I had to go to school and study about the American government. So the day came, and I'd done okay, I think, on a written test. And when I was interviewed, the official asked, among many things, he asked, that if there was a war, there is a war again between Japan and America, which side would you take? Hmm. I was stunned. I thought I never would fight against my country, where I was born, my mother's country, and fight against America, my father's country, so to speak. Those two shouldn't fight. But I can't take allegiance to only one side because I love two countries. My children are Americans, and my husband is an American, and I wanted to become American also, but not at the cost of taking sides. Oh, I should fight against two countries I love. So I sat there and cried. And officer asked, "Why are you crying?" I said, "Nothing, but I made up my mind that I'm going to live in America, and my family here is all American." So I said, "I'll take America's side." And after that, I really broke down. Hmm. And I passed the test. And official kept looking at me. And I thought, gee, if he didn't pass me, what shall I do, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I passed. And my husband was so happy and was going to take me to dinner. But I just couldn't stop crying. And he asked me why. I told him. And since then, that I swore to myself all my ability to stop the war, any war, but especially between Japan and America, I have to do this because I don't want to
choose.
Kill each other. I saw the war. I saw my city burned down and some of the people killed, and one of my school friend went out, and it's a ladies' school. Okay. My school is the oldest ladies' school in Japan.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. It's a Christian school. Mm-hmm. From Napoleon's time.
Wow, that's a cool school.
Anyhow, one of the schoolmates lived not too far from that department store. Oh, I forgot to tell you, we students were deployed, ordered by Japanese government to stop studying and work in the factory because all the men are out in the war. Mm-hmm. So I was 13, and my classmates about same age, and there was an old department store that the government took over. They are making a communication components because my school didn't allow anything to contribute to the war. So anyhow, one of the schoolmates went out when there was a lot of V-29s coming over to Yokohama. So she went out to go home, and instead the incendiary bomb landed on her. It was an unexploded bomb. And that night, I couldn't go home. And I had to sleep in an office chair. And a man said, "Don't open that chest of drawer, because there's a body of your school friend."
Oh, my goodness.
Mm. And chest of drawer like this, this high. And I wondered, she fit in that? Mm. Mm. And now, when I went to museum, Armstrong Museum, some time ago, there was a new display. I looked at it, and there was some the bomb they used in my the air raid in my city, you know, same model, sitting there, and I was struck. It's as big as that box there, and heavy, and I imagined that crushing
a little
girl.
Yeah.
And no wonder she bit in that drawer.
Yeah.
She was crushed.
Had that bomb exploded, would the school have been blown up?
Yeah. Our school was devastated. Mm. It's burned to ground, and only thing, I thought I would see the bell tower, but it was broken, and I just, my friend and I stood there and cried.
Do you think?
Anyhow, what I'm trying to say is war is terrible, and when I saw at that time, I'm going to do everything to make peace between people, country, and whatever. You know, I had very bitter experience. People, I'm listening to her, you know. They actually talked to me on the street and saying, "I have 2 hours until I catch plane, so let's go to hotel." What?
Oh, yeah. Like you were a worker.
I'm not the prostitute.
Yeah.
I worked in 8th Army for General MacArthur's army in the headquarters of human resources, like, you know, so we kept a record on all the in and outs of GIs who comes into Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And we even, well, me and my husband was dispatched to take care of the prisoners of war from Korea, the American prisoners who were sent back.
Mm-hmm.
And I done all these things for America,
mm-hmm.
and still segregated mm-hmm. from the people from both sides.
Does that weigh on your heart now at your age? Does that, over your life, having moved to this country and you were forced to choose, now at your age, do you feel, looking at your life, that you have a life of injustice, or are you feeling more at peace? That, you know, how do you live with that kind of bitterness about being treated so poorly your entire life, where you lived and...
Well, I think I'm at peace. Because I made friends. For instance, Matt and all the association members, church members, and even my garden club people. Like I said, people are people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they are, some of them are misguided, but you have to forgive them. It's the hardest thing you do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
And, but one day I had a real hatred. Someone mistreated me very badly. And my Christian friend prayed with me. And it just, I don't know, it's just that what I heard, a burden in my heart, just left me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can still make peace.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree.
I had good teachers, Miss Mary White, who was American and was going to be sent to back to America. She didn't want to because she's devoted her life in Japan. And she changed her nationality to Japan, Japanese, before they shipped her. She died in Japan.
Mm.
Of course, when Americans occupied Japan, she went back to be an American, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people, foreign people, American people, French people, all those people are basically good, but a lot of people are so misguided,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that seems to be a story that never changes. I mean, people are people, right?
And yeah. They never change.
So,
yeah.
I put my effort with Lima Sister Cities trying to let both people, country, to understand, to keep the peace and keep the friendship.
Yeah. So many powerful stories that you all have.
You know, she mentioned the two questions she had to answer.
Yeah.
Well, we had the same problem. Well, we were in camp when the war was getting bad. That's when they decided they would allow the Nisei men to enter into the armed forces to help. Until then, they wouldn't accept them.
Mm.
And so at that time, they would ask these fellows, we have two questions on the form that you have to fill out. One is, would you give your citizenship up? And the other one is, would you fight for America? And if you were to say no to both of them, you were put on the next ship going back to Japan. Mm-hmm. This is why a lot of the children of the parents that said no, no, they went, they had to go to Japan. If the parents answered it, everybody in the same family was shipped back to Japan. And this is why today there are quite a few Sanseis, the third generation, that were born to these people that were sent back to Japan. They are rather fluent in Japanese,
mm-hmm.
which sort of puts somebody like me to shame. But luckily, I can understand everything they speak to me. It's just that when I speak to them, my Japanese is not perfect. So what I say to my friends, because I have a lot of friends in Detroit that are with the Japanese companies, and a lot of ladies do not speak English, so they'll speak Japanese, and I have to apologize to them. In my broken Japanese, you know, I can answer that question, but my Japanese is very bad. And they just laugh, and they say, yeah, but our English is just as bad, so, you know, that's okay. So we become friends.
A quid pro quo.
Yeah, right? So that's two questions that everybody was asked. And yeah, if you said no, no to each one, they just
ship
them
off
back to Japan. Yeah. And so that's why you run into a lot of older senseis that had to go to Japan. They hated it, and they decided they wanted to come back. So a lot of the senseis here left their parents in Japan and came back to the United States because they didn't want to live in Japan. And I always say to them, do you kids go back to Japan to see your parents? Well, no, because they didn't care about us. They just took us back to Japan, and we didn't want to go. And I said, but, you know, that isn't fair for you to blame your parents. They had no choice.
Right.
If the government said, you're all going, you're all going to go. You're going to get on that boat and go. So I said, that's not fair for you to blame your parents for them dragging you to Japan, and you didn't want to live there. That's something that happened here. So they'd always ask me, so did you go to Japan? I said, no, I didn't go to Japan. My parents didn't say no, no. But if you said no, no to the questions, you got sent back just automatically, whether you lived there or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these things that have happened, when I speak to the university students, it's hard for them to believe, because this is America. And I said, well, it is. It has been America. But you have certain groups of people that are not going to change their mind. They're going to be just as hateful as they are today, 10 years down the road.
Yeah.
And the sad part of it is, they're turning their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this in the schools that I go to speak to. Mm-hmm. Some of the children can come out with some stupid remarks.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, the teacher will have to go and take them by the collar. That wasn't nice. Now, you apologize to her. I said, they don't need to apologize to me. I just consider the source.
Yeah.
And I said, and I have to believe that their parents, the parents of that young fellow that tore me down, doesn't do a good, very, very good job raising the children. So it isn't the child. The child isn't going to learn how to say those nasty things. They weren't even here on this earth. And I said, so, you know, I can put up with all this. I can put up with it. And you might notice I have answers for some of these kids that raise their hand and ask stupid questions. And I'll come back with a question, and they won't have an answer. And so, you know, all the things that we have lived with during the war, it's really unbelievable. But we've managed, because our parents are very strong. You never in my family said, I can't. Those were two words that my dad would not allow the kids to say, because he came here and he worked so hard, and he made it. Mm-hmm. So he says, if I made it, kids that are born here, you're educated, you will make it, and don't ever bring the two words in my house, I can't. And I used to listen to him, and I'd say to my mother after he left the room, my God, he's so mean. How come you married a man so mean? And she'd say, it's not that he's mean. That's our culture. And it'll make you a much better person if you listen to him more carefully. And I thought, geez, you can't even say I can't. I mean, there are things that you can't do, you know, regardless. But he always said, if you did it, you couldn't do it the first time, you try and try again.
We've been talking with Mary Kamadoy, who is a survivor of the Japanese internment camp during World War II, and also Keiko Han, who is a Japanese war bride, for lack of a better term, the subject of a War Brides documentary that's being released thanks to Matthew Neely, who is president of the Lima Sister Cities Association. We've also heard from Toledo Opera's Leah Whitaker. I want to thank all of you for talking with us today. Fascinating discussion, so many stories, and so many more to be told, I think, in this country and beyond. You've been listening to Opera Out of the Box, a co-production of WGTE Public Media and Toledo Opera, with additional support from Ohio Humanities.
You can find previous episodes online at our website, WGTE.org. And of course, you can dive into all things Toledo Opera and South Pacific at their website, which is ToledoOpera.org. I want to thank my guests one more time today. I'm your host, Brad Cresswell, and you've been listening to Opera Out of the Box.